from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraq has had its first free election in half a century. Palestinians have voted anew. Popular protest this week brought down Lebanon's pro-Syrian government, and Egypt made the surprise announcement last weekend that it will move toward more competitive presidential elections. The odds are still daunting, the challenges still towering, the outcome still a mystery. But events of the last month beg the question, is George W. Bush's vision of a democratic wave remaking the Middle East working? That vision has been richly mocked and deeply mistrusted. But this week it's getting another look. Tonight on Point, we'll ask what's really going on in the region's ripple of democratic ferment and where credit is due. We go first tonight to Washington. Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. I asked if the Bush administration is taking credit for the stirrings of democratic climate change in the Middle East.
They're taking a bit of credit, and they're responding with excitement, but also perhaps a little nervousness, because unleashing forces can always backfire. But they knew going into this that advocating democracy was the thing they wanted to do. I sense, however, that the administration is being very cautious about taking credit, and perhaps rightly so, because the more important factors in what's going on in the Middle East are probably things that the administration is connected to, but not just the words of the president, but the elections themselves in the Palestinian areas in January, in Iraq, of course, in Afghanistan, and other popular uprisings in the region, Ukraine and Georgia in particular.
So you've got what you describe as a region churning with fresh demands for democracy. There is, at some level, since democracy is put forward now as a prime justification for what's gone on and going on in Iraq, at some level there's a publicity win here for the president. But when they sit back and try to assess it quite apart from that, if it's possible, how much credit do they really think they deserve, or how much is internally generated?
I sense a certain amount of modesty, strangely enough, Tom. Maybe when it comes time to campaign in an election, you'll hear from President Bush claiming credit for these things. But I think that in their public statements, he, Secretary Rice, and other public spokesmen from the White House and the State Department are being careful not to take credit, because if for no other reason, that could dampen these little shoots of democracy in the Middle East. If it's seen as something being engineered from the outside, the U.S. still has a very low approval rating in that part of the world, and it would discredit any of the movements that the United States wants to nurture here.
President Bush has talked about democracy being the only path to long-term stability in the Middle East. But with this much change, there must be concerns about nearer-term instability, even chaos.
There are, and that's very well put. I think it's probably true that long-term democracy is the system that accommodates competing forces in any society best. But it's not just democracy that's needed, it's also institutions of a civil society that can be the building blocks of democracy, so that the democratic process of voting isn't overwhelmed by the handful of institutions that are there. Let me be less abstract. I mean, in Iraq, it's not that people don't want democracy, but if the only forces that can field candidates, especially when the situation has been as unstable there, are political parties, or in the case of Iraq, the Shiite religious groupings, if they're the only ones that can win an election because they're the only institutions in society strong enough to field candidates, then that can create more problems than it can solve. And that's what we're seeing in Iraq, although there's been an election. There's right now an impasse among the factions that have been elected on forming a government, and that could lead to more instability. The jury is still out there.
An impasse deep enough that Condoleezza Rice had to cancel her plans to visit Iraq this week because there wasn't a new government for her to meet with.
Yes, that was a factor. She had, of course, not announced the visit, so they won't be acknowledging that, but I mean, they didn't necessarily expect a full government to be formed this early, but they appear to have realized that when she went there, who was she going to meet with? And whoever she was going to meet with, it would look like she was endorsing that person in the jockeying over who's going to govern Iraq after the election.
Well, whatever's going on with that policy, it clearly is very close to the White House now with Condoleezza Rice, President Bush's great confidant in its State Department. And as you point out, Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter, Elizabeth Cheney, coming in as the new acting Assistant Secretary of State in charge of the Middle East, the top official at State for the Middle East.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, she has taken an interest in development issues in the first term. She was in charge of something called the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which, although it wasn't a lot of money, it was the one program where they tried to use seed money to develop civil institutions and women's rights in the Middle East. It was a program that I think even its supporters would say has achieved only limited success so far. And it's probably going to continue to be at the top of her agenda when she comes in. She, like her father and like others in the administration, really believes in it. And she's gotten a reputation as a capable administrator and a very articulate advocate and a pretty good listener in this area. But navigation of the real dangers in the Middle East, where the United States is going to have to choose how to protect its interests, and deal with situations that are less than ideal, I don't know that advocacy of democracy is the only value that you can bring to those problems.
Well, we will see if the House of Bush and Cheney gets more than it bargained for. Stephen Weissman, always great talking with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the shoots of democracy appearing in the Middle East, what they mean, and where credit is due. You can join the conversation. What do you see in this apparent ferment? Is it an affirmation of the Bush vision for democracy and stability in the Middle East? Or is this the Middle East in ferment independent of, in spite of, the American president? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio and glad to have him is Stephen Van Evre, professor of political science at MIT. Stephen Van Evre, thanks so much for being with us.
Welcome.
Tonight. We've been talking with you for, 3 years and more now about the American response to 9/11, about the American intervention in Iraq. You've been were a very skeptical observer of that intervention. Of course, democracy was not the cause for intervention given in advance, but it emerged afterward, as weapons of mass destruction didn't show up. And now here we see, after George Bush said, we'll plant the flag for democracy in Iraq and it will talk of this wave rolling across the Middle East, we see something that looks like not a wave, but a wavelet, a ripple. Is this the Bush vision coming true, coming to life, Stephen Van Evre?
Well, I think there's two questions here. First is democracy the answer in the Middle East? And I think we shouldn't take our eye off the ball. Our problem in the Middle East is al-Qaeda and nuclear weapons and the combination of the two. And our principal concern should be to defeat al-Qaeda and, in the meantime, prevent it from getting nuclear weapons. We should promote democracy to the extent that promoting democracy advances that larger cause, because that cause overrides all other causes. So first question is Bush correct to say that democracy is the answer to everything in the Middle East? I think the more nuanced way of looking at it, more correct way, is a more democratic Middle East would be somewhat more amenable to our efforts against al-Qaeda. But it would not end the problem with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda can survive perfectly fine in a democratic Middle East. Democracy is not some kind of silver bullet that kills terror.
But you know the logic chain that the Bush camp lays down, and it is you've got governments that are not responsive to the people, that are not answering the needs of the people, that are not releasing the energies of the people. This leads to anger. This leads to terrorism. This leads to al-Qaeda. Bring democracy, and you kind of cut off the supply of angry, alienated people in the Middle East who join the ranks of al-Qaeda.
I agree with that, and I think there's another argument, too, which is that crazy ideas tend to be dampened in societies where there's free speech, because if you're crazy, you got to confront
blow off some steam,
right? Mm-hmm. And your critics tend to shave the sharp edges off.
Call you, yep.
Exactly. So I agree with that, but I think it's still only a partial answer. If we look at the history of terror, we've seen terror flourish in democratic societies. Om Shinrikyo in Japan, and the Red Brigades in Italy, and the Bottom-Meinhof gangs. So I mean, terrorists are not eliminated once you have some elections.
But step back, you're kind of moving the camera over to the side here. The United States is not only focusing on building democracy. There's a lot of intelligence and military force being put down to go after al-Qaeda. Is it time to give President Bush some due for uncorking a democratic, I don't know what to call it, stirring, ripple here? Does he deserve credit for that?
Second question is mm-hmm. Effort to unleash democracy working? And I think the jury's completely out on that. The big enchilada there is Iraq. The theory is that Iraq's going to be a democracy and provide an example, a democratic domino that will topple the other dominoes in the Middle East.
Some in Washington saying that's already working. They had elections January 30th, and now already you've got Egypt, you've got Lebanon, you've got, right on.
Oh, I think the fate of Iraq is totally up in the air. We're in terrible trouble in Iraq. Things are extremely precarious there. All of Sunni land remains outside our control. We just had the biggest attack since we won the war.
122 dead yesterday
exactly,
in one bombing.
Exactly. And the number of attacks has not diminished in a significant way since the election. So we've not solved the problem of the insurgency yet. We also have not solved the problem of the Kurds yet. A year from now, we could be having a three-way civil war. So we've got the short-term problem of the Sunni insurgency not solved.
Is democracy even in America's interest in the Middle East?
Oh, yes.
It is?
Yes.
But
it's
you're
just not the answer
as,
to everything.
And it's,
let's not take our eye off the other ball.
Don't take the eye off the ball. How much credit does the Bush administration deserve? We're talking tonight about signs of democracy stirring in the Middle East and whether the Bush vision might just be working. I'm joined by Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT. You can join the conversation as well. Is this it? Is it happening? Has Bush sparked the beginnings of a democratic makeover of the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about signs of democracy stirring in the Middle East and whether the Bush vision might just be working. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is this it? Is it happening? Has Bush sparked the beginnings of a democratic makeover of the Middle East? Or is this the Middle East in ferment in spite of the American president? Is it time for those who mocked Bush's high-flown language to eat crow, at least a little crow? Or was Washington's call for democracy always a smokescreen for intervention that may now be getting out of control? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight in the studio by Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT. We're joined right now from New York by Fawad Ajami, director of Middle East Studies at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Fawad Ajami, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here it is. You said it would come if we only acted to help it be born. Is this it, Fawad Ajami? Is this the democratic wave that you and others predicted would come? Has it arrived? Is it arriving?
Well, I don't really like running victory laps, and I don't like running them in the Middle East because it's a very dangerous neighborhood to run victory laps. But it's an important moment. It's an exhilarating moment. I watch the land of my birth. I watch Lebanon. Mm. I watch these young people take to the streets. I watch them make of their grief for their fallen leader, Rafiq Hariri, a new chapter. And I watch them inspired by what they watch and what they witness in the Ukraine, the Orange Revolution of the Ukraine. And I watch this making of a new history in the Arab world. Having chronicled the heartbreak of the Arab world, I am really thrilled to see this moment.
Pick apart what's going on here. How much credit is due to Washington, to the Bush administration, and how much is this driven by other influences? I mean, after all, right. Ukraine has been widely cited in Lebanon. The Palestinians
Absolutely.
Are voting, but Yasser Arafat died, and that's an act of nature, not of Bush. So where does credit belong here?
Well, I think you ask a very legitimate and a very important question. I think first let's grant President Bush his due. Let's grant American power its due. Because for 60 years, as President Bush himself stated in a celebrated speech before the National Endowment for Democracy, the American bet had been on autocracy, on dictatorship. We feared the coming of democratic revolutions to the Middle East because we feared Islamists would hijack them and ride them to power. So in Iraq, we took a risk, if you will, on the democratic process. And indeed, the democratic process was vindicated in brilliant colors, as the Lebanese have also been telling us, that they watch these 8.5 million Iraqis go to the polls and vote and risk death and risk upheaval and risk violence. So I think it's a moment of many, many, many fathers, if you will.
And what about the fear that what gets unleashed here may be democratic, but may be very hostile to the United States? I mean, we see the polls that suggest tremendous Arab hostility toward the United States in the wake of the Iraq war, tremendous, deep hostility. Against that backdrop, can Washington really claim credit as an inspiration for democracy? And if it comes, is it a good thing for the U.S.?
Well, I think sometimes, you know, there is a separation between message and messenger. I mean, many, many Arabs are saying we love the message, but we don't trust the messenger, meaning the American messenger. But I just want to caution you on these public opinion polls that show anti-Americanism in the Arab world. Treat this with extreme caution. These are fake polls. These are just, in fact, you know, there is something to them. They're supplied on demand. You ask people, what do you think of America? You get these stock answers. I think there is tremendous, tremendous ambivalence about the United States. The young Lebanese who've taken to the streets are looking to American power to redeem their hopes. I think we should be very, very careful. We should not succumb to the self-flagellation that we are not loved in the Arab world. Let the Arabs make their own destiny. Let them arrive at their own history. We can ride this wave. We can ride this democratic wave.
For what, Jimmy, I have to ask you personally,
sure.
You know, you've been out in front on championing this effort, and you've taken heat for it. You've taken hard knocks for it. The Nation called you the native informant, kind of the native front man for the neocons. Do you feel redeemed?
Well, I think I don't really. It's not so much about redemption. I mean, I've gone to Iraq 3 times. It was never pretty getting there. It was never safe getting there, but I very much believed in this effort in Iraq, and I felt if I believed in it enough, I should be able to walk the streets of Iraq. I should go with the American soldiers. I should walk with the Iraqis. I should listen to the Iraqis. So I hail this moment. I hail it in Iraq. We thought there would be this big Shia triumph, this monster Shia juggernaut. We didn't see it. This United Iraqi List won 48% of the votes, and many, many of them are people I know and people I trust and people I've known for many years. So I think it's a very, very remarkable moment. We are trying. We are trying to break with the Arab legacy of despotism and with the Arab legacy of dictatorship. It's not easy. And we have paid a terrible price, as we know. 1,500 of our people have been killed in Iraq. So we don't celebrate too loudly.
Stephen Venevra, there it is. Fawad Ajami says not ready to take a victory lap, but he's ready to dance in the end zone a little bit and put a kind of laurel crown on the Bush administration. He says for 60 years we placed our bet on autocracy in the Middle East, and we're shifting it now in favor of democracy. A, do you agree that's happening? The Saudis are still there. So is this shift even for real? And Mubarak is still there, despite some appearance of liberalization, perhaps. And B, is it the right bet for American interests?
Yeah, yes, it is true. We've made a shift. Up through the 90s and up until recently, the Mideast was the exception to America's pro-democratic policy. Basically, the U.S. became fairly pro-democratic in its foreign policy somewhere in the 80s under Reagan, but made an exception for the Mideast. In the Mideast, we're going to do business as usual, pal around with the old monarchs and dictators. You know, the sort of darkest story of that time was when we went along with the French canceling the election in Algeria.
And that was true right through the Clinton years.
Correct. And also backing the Saudi monarchy and Mubarak, never challenging Mubarak, never asking him to pluralize. And we have made a change. And I think that to some extent we're seeing the fruits of it in Egypt. I don't think Egypt would today be saying, you know, we're going to have a real election next time if it weren't for U.S. pressure.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Condoleezza Rice said, I'm not going there because you've got Ayman Nour in prison until this political prisoner is released, I can't come.
Correct.
And that's in your face.
Right. We can't read minds, but I bet that U.S. pressure had a lot to do with that. But we can overstate how big the changes are. Basically, I'm a preconditions guy. I don't think you get democracy if the preconditions aren't there. And throughout the Mideast, the preconditions are scarce. We shouldn't be too optimistic here. The analogy, you know, this is unfair to bring up Haiti, okay? But Haiti's an extreme case where in 91, before we went in, everyone thought we're going to fix the place. And or 94 when we went in. But the preconditions weren't there, and people like me warned, you know, don't set the bar too high because There's the rate of literacy is too low. There's no middle class. State institutions don't exist. Now, the Arab world is in much better shape than Haiti, but it's in worse shape than Latin America.
So is it a mistake to support democracy in the Middle East?
No. We should support it where we can do it cheaply, where the odds of success are high, where we can do it without damaging our own standing or our own position, where we can do it without violence. We should do it. And we did the right thing pushing Egypt, okay? And I think we should push other states toward pluralism. But we shouldn't make the democratization of the region the hinge of our policy. We shouldn't expect too much, and we sure shouldn't invest too much in the project, because it's a very difficult project, and it's not going to get us all the way home.
Do you consider the multi-hundred-billion-dollar investment in Iraq an investment in democracy?
Well, that's where we are today. We're trying to bring it about, and I think the cost is way too high. You know, my view is we should have stayed focused on al-Qaeda. We should stay focused on them today. And democratizing the Mideast is a sideshow in that larger struggle. It's a piece of a puzzle, but we should be worrying about other stuff first and foremost. The most important thing is winning the war of ideas in the Mideast.
I want to begin to bring in our callers. Dean is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Dean. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello, Dean. You're on, my friend.
Yes, sir. I just want to make a comment. Democracy is the answer, because I lived in the Middle East for 19 years before I moved here.
What country, Dean?
It's in Syria.
All right.
And this country gave me what was taken away from me over there. I started my life. I started new life. I have a hope. And there is a lot of people, millions of people in the Middle East. They need that hope.
Do you believe that democracy is coming to the Middle East now, even to Syria,
yes,
Dean?
I believe George Bush is a man of his word. When he says he will bring democracy to the Middle East, he will. And I believe this policy is going to work in the long run. And believe me, I visited the Middle East recently. There is millions of people looking at George Bush for him to come over there and just give those people freedom.
So there's the vote from the Syrian American, and we hear it loud and clear. Dean, thanks very much for your call. For what a Jami, Stephen Van Ever, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington tonight, Samer Shahada. He's a visiting assistant professor of Middle East politics at Georgetown's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's taught at the American University in Cairo. Samer Shahada, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
So here we have the events of the last month and more. You've heard Stephen Van Evere and Fawad Ajami's interpretations of what's going on here. You heard Dean calling in, Syrian now in America, saying this is giving hope to millions. How do you interpret what's happening with democracy and the Bush push in the Middle East?
Well, it's certainly an exciting moment in the region, and there is a tremendous amount of movement and ferment. I think, however, we have to be somewhat cautious in our analysis. I mean, there's no question that democracy promotion or being on the side of democracy is a good policy, and unfortunately the United States has taken quite some time to get to that policy. But I think that we have to ask ourselves, what is the best way to promote democracy? And I think certainly in terms of our aid, how we allocate it, in terms of what kinds of statements the State Department makes, who we decide to visit to our country, and so forth, those are very, very good steps. But with regard to a kind of military policy of promoting democracy, I think that's where we have to draw the line.
But if you judge by results, there's the election in Iraq, and here's these other shoots we see coming up. Do those indicate that judging by results, the intervention in Iraq has been effective in promoting democracy or not?
I think that the verdict is still very, very much out. I mean, we saw, for example, over 120 people killed yesterday in Iraq. We see basic services less than they were before the start of the war, and so on. So I'm not trying to completely discount the argument that the Bush concentration on democracy promotion has not had any consequence. No, I think certainly we need to give some credit to where it's due, at least in terms of highlighting this issue, the absence of good governance and democracy in the region. But I think it would be a mistake also to not take into consideration fully local factors. I mean, for years there have been human rights organizations in the region, opposition political parties, democracy activists, and so forth, who have been struggling away without attention, by the United States or others and so on.
And
they've taken advantage of this moment to open up political spaces from autocratic regimes.
Did the Bush administration create this moment? Do you give it that credit or not?
I think that there's been a dynamic. I don't think they've created the moment. I mean, if, for example, if we look at the Egyptian case very carefully. The opposition parties have for quite some time been talking about the necessity of constitutional reform and direct presidential elections well before anyone knew who Ayman Nour was, the imprisoned member of parliament and party leader and so on. There is a dynamic, a kind of dialectic that is taking place between outside attention as well as these local actors who have been struggling for some time for human rights and rule of law and good governance and so on.
Mark is calling from Arcadia, California. Arcata, excuse me. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for the show.
Sure.
Now, if there is a democracy movement afoot in the Middle East, and I do believe that there is, I think the credit goes toward the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims and the Persian and the Arab Muslims in the Middle East.
That's why? Just about everybody. What do you
why?
Mean?
Why? Just why? Because, I say because after 50 years of U.S. and Israeli policy practicing a double standard in the Middle East, these Arab countries in that region see an opportunity to call the United States and Israel on their double standard, namely their request to get the Syrian military out of Lebanon, when in fact we have the U.S. military in Iraq as an occupier and the Israeli military in the Gaza and West Bank as occupiers. So they see this as an opportunity. This is a populist movement throughout the Persian, Arab, Sunni, Shiite, Middle Eastern world that is standing up and taking hold, and they deserve the credit for calling the U.S. and Israel on their double standard.
We'll talk about that, Mark. But let me ask you: Will it work for American interests?
Criminal court, right?
Mark, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call, Fawad Ajami. Let's turn to this question of Israel, longtime deep ally of the United States.
Sure.
If democracy is stirring here, if that's where we're headed, is this good for Israel or? Mark's putting forward the view that this is the Middle East sort of rising up to refute American policy on Israel and perhaps Israel itself. How does democracy work for that ally?
Well, actually, Israel is on the margins of this great struggle. It's really a struggle between Arab authoritarianism and these new possibilities of history. It's about these old autocrats, reigning autocrats and their sons standing in the wings who have plundered the world of the Arabs, who have hoarded state wealth and state power. Israel really has always been an alibi for this Arab ruling class. And if democracy should come to the Arab land, so be it. The Israelis would welcome it.
Samer Shahada, how do you see it? Good for Israel, not good for Israel?
Well, I think it's good for everyone, really, in the long and medium term. But there are very serious questions that are raised if democratic governments were to come to power in throughout the Middle East regarding Israel and regarding U.S. interests. For example, if we did really have truly representative governments in Jordan and Egypt, it might be the case, it probably would be the case, that they would want to end their peace agreements with Israel or at least renegotiate them and would probably be much more active in their support for Palestinian rights. And if we move to the Gulf countries, where the U.S. has military facilities and the army is operating in all of the Gulf countries, I would imagine that all of those citizens would probably not want the U.S. military presence there. So I think these are some of the implications we need to think about as well.
Steve Vinevra, so here we sit. And, you know, we've heard it today. We've read as well. The White House is being low-key in its response to this. But its many supporters are really, putting this right up front as a triumph for the administration. You're saying, be careful, go after al-Qaeda, don't put all your eggs in this basket. Can't these two things happen simultaneously? Can't you support democracy and go after al-Qaeda?
Well, yes, but I don't want to get distracted. I mean, the project we've undertaken in Iraq was hugely expensive. It involved lots of money. It involved lots of talent. It involved moving, you know, forces out of Afghanistan into Iraq and, leaving bin Laden on the run. It's drained the treasury. It takes up our national management time. We need to have our national brain power focused on the problem. Democratizing the Middle East will help with the problem, and therefore we ought to push it when we can do it within feasible limits. Spending $200-300 billion on democratizing Iraq, I think that was a bit exorbitant. And dangerous. And so far, I think it's backfired.
So you would have kept your foot off the accelerator, sort of talked in favor of democracy, but not intervened with that kind of military intervention.
In Iraq, yes. Although I would have done what the U.S. did in Egypt. I would have, you know, jawboned them toward pluralism.
But would it have meant nearly as much without the leverage of the example of Iraq sitting there?
I don't think the example of Iraq yet is really resonating. I think this is a falsehood. I mean, people look at Iraq and they see a lot of chaos. They see a big mess. It's not at all clear that real democracy is emerging from the country yet. And I think this general trend that you're pointing to, I see it as part of a long-term trend where we've seen the shoots of democracy coming up for the last decade or more in the Mideast. We've seen parliaments developing in Kuwait and Oman and elsewhere in Bahrain. And so I think that you can overstate the impact. I just think the notion that we've really had democratic dominoes falling yet is very unclear. I mean, even to make – what do we make of what's happening in Lebanon? Is this a nationalist rebellion or a democratic rebellion? To me, it looks more like a nationalist rebellion.
At the moment, get the Syrian troops, the 14,000 troops out. Of course, Syria's president saying today that that may just happen in the next few months. So things happening. Fawad Ajami, Samer Shahada, Stephen Venever, please stand by. We're talking tonight about signs of democracy stirring in the Middle East and whether the Bush vision might just be working. What happens in a simultaneous surge in anti-American sentiment and popular uprising? Where does this all go? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about signs of democracy stirring in the Middle East and how much credit might be due to the Bush administration. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see a democratic revolution in the making here or something else? Is it wildly self-centered for America to claim credit, some credit, or is the Bush vision being affirmed? And is it time to worry about the consequences of democratic experimentation in the Middle East? What would it mean for American interests? We're 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by MIT's Stephen Venever, by Fawad Ajami at Johns Hopkins University, and Samer Shahada at Georgetown. Right now, Ernst is calling from Black Wolf, Wisconsin. Hi, Ernst. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you. What's on your mind, Ernst?
Well, what I find is that this is a repetition once again. We would have had the media back in the 1700s and 1800s. I'm sure the British citizens would have been speaking the same way. I remember from, I told you a skinny interview from the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, one of my favorite scenes was the Arab gentleman, after he had been kissed by the heroine, going off to sing a British song. All sorts of people in the empire were singing the British song. India managed to come through, but mainly through the intervention of Gandhi.
So you're saying these great power interventions don't produce lasting democracy? Is that the point?
Well, they never take the seedbed which exists in Islam itself, in the triple base of Islam, the Hadith, the Quran, and the Ummah. There is the community. This, to me, is the basis from which democracy could grow in Islamic way.
So look to Islam, not to the West. Ernst, thanks for your call. Fawad Ajami, here's the Raiders of the Lost Ark critique of what's going on. But what about it? Can democracy and Islam work together? Is this a democracy? Can the United States encourage a democracy that's rooted in Islam?
Well, look, I'm a secularist. I really believe that in fact, the Arab world went wrong, deeply and thoroughly wrong, when the lower middle classes came into politics in the late 60s and early 70s.
When the lower middle classes came into politics?
Exactly, came into politics and brought with them this kind of passion for religious literalism, that the Quran had to be interpreted literally. I think we have to return.
Well, be careful. I mean, there's a lot of that going on in the U.S. right now.
Exactly. And I am a deep and thorough critic of that which is going on in the United States. I remain fundamentally, by the way, at heart, a Kemalist. That is for Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who believed in the total separation of religion and politics.
The great Turkish secularist.
Exactly. And that is therein lies the salvation of the Arabs. The less religion and politics, the better.
But aren't you singing pretty far out of tune with what, to American ears, looks like the mainstream in the Middle East these days?
I don't mind being alone. I truly believe in the secular nature of politics. I don't believe that going around, looking around, searching for good imams who will agree with us on this or that interpretation is the way to do it. We have to believe in the secular world. We have to believe in ordinary men and women making this new history without the intervention of religious scripture and the intervention of religious authorities.
Samer Shahada, do you see a hope of that? Religion seems to be revved up pretty high in the Middle East. Is there a secular seedbed for democracy there? Does it need one? Can there be an Islamic democracy that's good for the region and not bad for the U.S.?
Well, I don't know if there's really a difference between Islamic democracy and democracy generally, but I see no contradiction between Islam and democracy. And I think this gets to the point that the political systems that develop in places like Iraq and in Iran and Egypt will have to have local roots, and people will have to speak languages that they understand. It will not be a Jeffersonian language. It might be an interpretation of Islam that values and champions consultation and participation in a kind of Islamic way, and principles of justice and equality in an Islamic rhetoric, and so on. That doesn't bother me, as long as the principles of liberal democracy with a capital L are abided by. I think that's what we all want to see.
Nino's calling from Norwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Nino. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Ajami's comment spoke right to my heart, but that's not what I was calling about. I was calling about something that... We have to be very careful not to put the cart in front of the horse.
How do you mean?
Because we saw this happen before, and just because we call something democracy doesn't make it democracy.
Where have we seen it happen before?
We celebrated the overthrow of Milosevic in Serbia, and who was nationalist, mm-hmm. and was obviously a terrible mm-hmm. tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
But for anyone who lived in that area for any substantial period of time, as I had, knows immediately, sees that people who overthrew him were same nationalists that Milosevic was.
So let's not be naive here.
Absolutely. Democracy has to come from within countries. They have to decide, do they want to take this path or not? Same as they have to decide, do they want to be a part of free markets, the economy or not.
But when you see tens of thousands of Lebanese in the streets, doesn't that look like it's coming from within?
Potentially, yes. Now, is that good or not? We'll see. We have to see what time will show us. We also saw in Jordan a few years ago tens of thousands of fundamentalist Islamists protesting. I don't think we call that democracy.
Nino, we've got it. They're the voice who, having observed former Yugoslavia, saying just because we call it democracy doesn't make it so or make it lasting. Let's get another call. Giselle is calling from Norwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Giselle. You're on the air.
Yes, I think, Mr. Ashbrook, you're always provoking with your introduction. You speak about Bush's vision. I don't think he has a vision, especially for democracy, because we know that fellows who advise him have published, it's well easy to find, you know where to find the website, you know, the Doctrine for the New Century.
The New American Century Project and so on.
Yeah, whatever. You had the Terry Jones.
But where are you going with this, Giselle? You're doubting...
Excuse me, I'm going to the fact that the democracy is a smoke screen, as you said, somebody said smoke screen, that is a pretense that what they wanted to do is subjugate Iraq, make it a more or less stable place, probably with a dictator. Whether they're still looking for a dictator, I don't know, or for some kind of puppet democracy, whatever, but they're not looking for democracy.
So you're not buying the honesty of the vision. You're going with the smokescreen line.
You know, there's no honesty. I mean, those people have lied so many times, and who believes them? I don't like that. I mean, I know you do it on purpose, but people to hear that Bush has a vision. I mean, Bush has lied, or has repeated the lies that he was told, which is probably the same. And what they want is, the last thing is, what nobody mentions in these discussions is the oil and the other resources. What they are after is dominating, getting the oil. The other thing that's not mentioned is the debt and the destruction. And you don't get democracy, full democracy and wonderful life through killing and destroying a country. I mean,
Giselle, we've got it, and we hear it loud and clear, and oil's the next big word on my list here, but let us pick both of those up. Samer Shahada, first of all, Giselle's calling in. She's read... some of the neoconservative, you know, thinking before the war.
For a new American century.
That's right. And
so
she says
on.
She just doesn't buy it, that the goal all along in black and white was regional domination, not regional democracy promotion.
Sure.
How do you see it?
Sure. I think there's actually some truth in this. I don't think that the Bush administration has one mind or speaks with one voice. I think that some people in the administration, some civilians in the DOD and some neoconservatives and so forth, have used the democracy rhetoric quite advantageously to push for this war, which they've had in mind for quite some time and which had very little to do with democracy. At the same time, I think there are other people who genuinely believe that democracy is the antidote to terrorism from the Middle East, and that if the Middle East were to become democratic, that would make America safe. I think that is partially correct, but I don't think that is completely correct. I think if we saw democracies flourish from Morocco to Malaysia, for example, but the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was not sorted out in a just and equitable manner, and if we still had the numbers of American troops we have in the region, we would still see terrorist acts, unfortunately, directed at the United States.
Stephen Venever, this goes to a point I've heard you make repeatedly, that maybe that great effort, maybe some of that great pile of money would be better focused on the Palestinian situation.
Well, there is something. Giselle wonders what the motives of the administration are, and there is an oddity to the sort of shape of their approach in the Mideast. If they want to promote democracy in the Mideast, there's one obvious place where they ought to do it, which is Palestine.
But they just voted there, so what more is needed?
Well, the Palestinians need a state. They need to build a state. It's true that I think that they've basically launched democracy there, but it doesn't mean much without the control of their own territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the place where you see the preconditions for democracy, very high level of literacy, democratic culture among the elite. If you ask most Palestinians today, what country would you most like a new Palestinian state to model its government upon? Mm. They say, of all things, Israel. Their long contact with Israel has sort of westernized their political culture. So this is the place where democracy is most likely to flourish with the least amount of input from us. And that's where the administration ought to put its chips if it wants to bring into being a democratic state.
Preconditions, to use your term, you see them there in a would-be Palestine more than in Iraq. Fawad Ajami, how about it? Has the big bet been placed and very expensively on the wrong mark here?
With all due respect to my colleague, I think this is kind of ideology. It's basically asking the Bush administration to do these miraculous things on the West Bank in Gaza. The Palestinians have to slay their own demons. They have this Islamic Jihad. They have these forces of Hamas. They are killers. They are killers. They are religious, political fascists.
But aren't they trying to slay those demons right
exactly
now?
That's exactly right. That's their burden. It's the burden of Mahmoud Abbas and his leadership. It's the burden of the Palestinian middle classes to turn back the forces of terror, to make the choice in favor of peace. It's not really an American burden, and it's not really even an Israeli burden. It's the Palestinians themselves. They must forsake the way of terror, and they must be made to understand that no one will come looking for them. No one will give them support if they persist in the ways of terror. And that's exactly what Bush did by holding out against an accommodation with Yasser Arafat, by refusing to meet Yasser Arafat 13 times in the Oval Office, as Bill Clinton did. He put the Palestinians before a stark historic choice, and you know what? Guess what? They made the right choice.
And now they're talking stiff and whenever. How about it? Fawad Ajami says, well, they've applied just the right kind of pressure there.
Well, Fawad, I'd sort of suggest the U.S. doesn't have a role to play there, but I think we have a huge role to play, knocking heads on both sides to bring a state into being.
Right.
Palestinian democracy will flourish if we get a peace settlement. And if we do that, we're going to have a great combo in the Middle East, the democratic Israel, democratic Palestine. They're going to lead the region. It's not going to happen, though, if they fall back into war. And they are going to fall back into war if we don't get a settlement. And that's not going to happen without American leadership.
Mm-hmm. So, Samer Shahadat, we've just got half a minute left here. Let's go to one baseline interest, oil. We see the ferment around the region. Don't know what it will amount to yet. Is it good for keeping the oil flowing to the voracious American oil appetite?
Well, I think there are two mindsets on this question. There's the mindset of Condoleezza Rice when she articulated, I think, last year that the Arabs can't drink the oil, that they have to sell it and so on, and it's a commodity like any other. But then there is the mindset, I think, of many kind of strategic thinkers that the U.S. needs to have military bases in the region and a quick strike capacity to make sure that oil continues to flow steadily to Western and Japanese and other markets.
So the tension's always going to be there, also the oil for sale. Samer Shahadat at Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, thank you very much for being with us tonight. And Fawad Ajami, we hear it's not a victory lap, but we saw a couple of fist pumps there. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank
you. Fawad Ajami at Johns Hopkins. Stephen Venever, professor of political science at MIT. Always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a young Lebanese American and her new hopes for Lebanon. This is On Point. Lebanese-American Rima Arno has visited Lebanon several times since the end of the civil war that racked the country for decades. Now she worries that the February 14th assassination of Prime Minister Rafik Hariri and the protests that have followed could lead to the type of violent unrest that kept her away from Lebanon for most of her childhood. In this radio diary, Rima Arno talks of her hopes that democracy, not chaos, is coming to Lebanon.
Rafik Hariri was known for rebuilding Beirut's devastated downtown after the civil war almost 15 years ago. He put his personal money and business contacts into it, which may have made people love him all the more. It may also have been one reason his assassins wanted to kill him. I have a coffee table book on the new Beirut downtown. On each two facing pages are photos of the same Beirut street, one after the destruction at the end of the civil war, and one after the rebuilding. The book's cover is like one of those cereal box holograms. When you look at it from one angle, you see the old destroyed city. But you look at it from the other angle, and it's the shiny new downtown. The new downtown Beirut looks like Paris would if it were in Italy. Natural stone, handsome iron balconies and lampposts, stone-paved streets with outside cafes, people chatting and eating and drinking all night. The last time I was there, pop singer Shaggy performed across from Martyr Square. Since Hariri's assassination, a whirlwind of domestic and international furor has descended on that downtown. Protesters are marching on Martyr Square, and Lebanon's government resigned. As the chaos continues, I've found myself looking at my coffee table book, wondering whether the seemingly stable new Lebanon might disappear, taken away from me once again by violence and instability. Mobs are out on Martyr Square right now. I know the places described in the news these days well, but I can't quite recognize them in the pictures I see in the papers. As I read news accounts, I wonder, are the protesters bearing peaceful, democratic messages? Are they truly representative of Lebanon's multi-religious, multi-ethnic population? Or are they supporters of one of the old factions looking again for trouble? Friends and family in Lebanon are seeing the events firsthand. They tell me they can't tell either whether they are evidence of genuine grassroots democracy that will calm down when its goals are met, or political instability which will get more and more chaotic, shaking the foundations of the newly rebuilt city. One friend told me, there's chaos and democracy. There's fear. There's everything. If this is part of the tumult of democracy, I hope America will be watchful but patient without pressing our agenda. After all, President Bush has stated that democracy is what he wants for the Arab world, and we know that democracy isn't always pretty. If the situation descends into more chaos, I hope the international community will be ready to intervene. The Lebanese Patriarch Cardinal Nasrallah Boutros Sfer is coming to Washington in the next couple weeks, which means some political change is afoot. I can only hope by then that the recent events in Lebanon will have paved the way for democratic change, and not a return to chaos.
Rima Arno is a Lebanese-American and a student at Harvard Medical School. She lives in Brookline, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.